This is the current federal tax developments for the week of June 19, 2017. This is brought to you by the Los Scalzo Institute and by your State Society of CPAs. This week, the heat is now actually on because we're getting to summer, and we're going to be looking at some of the developments this week that are coming out in taxes. This week, you're going to find that we're going to have a very disappointed ex-CEO of Quest that discovers the Supreme Court does not want to hear his appeal. We're also then going to go on and talk about a case of S Corporation and ESOP plan participants and the issue of can you accrue wages and deduct them for an ESOP plan participant if the ESOP is owning shares in your S Corp. The IRS also gives out an email that discussed the Mescalero case and how that applies in terms of an exam structure. The IRS also finally got out the Bipartisan Budget Act proposed regulations for the new audit regime, and we'll talk about how that comes and what's actually changed in the new regulations. The answer is not much. And finally, we're going to talk about disaster relief and whether that can actually help you if when the IRS gives an extended period of time to comply with filing documents with the service after a natural disaster, how does that impact people that are already out of compliance before the disaster? Does that suspend the running of interest and penalties for that time period, or does it not? Well, we've got a few courses coming up in August here. And in August, we're going to be doing on August 9th, a fringe benefits course in Phoenix. These are the Arizona courses at this point. So I'll be teaching a day of fringe benefits for 8 hours. On August the 10th, I'll be teaching a course on preparing Form 1041. And on August 11th, the course Ethics and Quality Control and Tax Practice. These courses will be held at the Arizona Society of CPAs offices. If you've not been there recently, please remember this year as you go to courses, they are now going to be on the first floor of the building, not the second floor, so don't walk upstairs. These courses will also be broadcast as webcasts. If you want to attend any of these courses, you can sign up at the Arizona Society's website at ascpa.com. I'll also be this week, I'm heading off to New Jersey, which is probably a good thing because it turns out the weather here in Phoenix is expected to rise to about 120. And while I realize it's been a little warm on the East Coast, it hadn't been quite that warm. And so even going to a place that's not ready maybe for temperatures to be up around 90-something, it's still probably going to be a little nicer than being around here where if you step outside, you kind of notice 120 when that happens. Let's talk about the cases now. Let's start with the case of Nacho versus Commissioner. This was came from the Court of Claims, number 2015-5114 and 2015-5115. The opinion was issued on June 10th of last year, but we just this week had certiorari denied by the Supreme Court on the 12th of June this month. Now, in this case, the problem here arose, there was a payment related to the receipt by the taxpayer of proceeds from selling stock where it was accused he had played with insider trading. And eventually he was convicted of those charges and he had to pay back a gain of over $44 million. Now, this was in addition to a $19 million fine. No question, the $19 million fine was not deductible. But he argued he should be able to take a deduction for the $44 million, which he had to pay back to get rid of the gains that he had gotten, his ill-gotten gains, because the Department of Justice had agreed that if he paid that amount to them, that they expected to return that to the victims, you know, those who had purchased shares when the price was being, you know, artificially driven up or down, however you want to look at it. Based upon his purchases and playing on insider information. So because of that, he said, I should be able to deduct them either under the claim of right statute, and so as a claim of right under 1341, so I get the credit, or at the very least, I should get a deduction of 165 because that's a deduction for a loss. The Court of Federal Claims, though, said, no, that's not really how this works. The statute under which he had to give up his ill-gotten gains did not require the government to pay it back to the victims. That was totally within the government's discretion to do so. And while the government indicated that it expected to do so, it certainly wasn't bound to do so. And so the court found that realistically, Congress had intended this to be a punitive measure, not a just, you know, repay back and make your victims whole. So because of that, the court found that he could claim no deduction. As you might guess, when you get denied a $44 million deduction or a credit on that $44 million to give you back the tax you had paid when you recognize the gain, that's a lot of bucks. So not surprisingly, he appealed the case and he lost. So then he tried to get the Supreme Court to hear the case. Well, the bad news for him was the Supreme Court really doesn't like tax cases. And in this case, there was no obvious reason why the court had to pick it up. There wasn't any sort of, you know, huge difference in the circuits. You don't have a whole lot of this sort of $44 million gain cases flying around. So the Supreme Court decided that they simply would just deny to certiorari, not hear the case. So bad news for this gentleman. He's not going to get a deduction or any benefit for repaying the $44 million worth of gains. Next up, we have a published tax court case, Peterson versus Commissioner, 148 TC number 22, issued on June the 13th. In the Peterson case, we are looking at the issue of what happens if you have an accrual basis S corporation and you have an ESOP that owns that, where the beneficiaries are your employees. Do those participants in the plan, can you accrue wages payable to them that you're going to pay the following year and claim a deduction? Obviously, you can accrue them. The question is, can we claim a deduction? And the problem there is Code Section 267. Under Section 267, accrued payments to any cash basis shareholder are not deductible until paid by the S corporation. This is different than our 267 for a C corporation, where it has to be a 50% interest. But in this case, no, any interest, as small as possible, you know, 0.1% interest is enough to cause a problem. And 267 does refer to trust as problems. If you are a beneficiary of a trust that is holding shares for you in the corporation, that is deemed to make you related enough to trigger this section. So the question becomes, does Congress really mean that an ESOP has to cover the, has to be treated this way? Well, the taxpayers said that can't be right. And they said, well, look, here's some things. First thing is, really, we think 318 that deals with constructive ownership of stock should be applied. And 318 specifically says qualified retirement plans are not considered for at constructive ownership of stock under 318. So because they don't constructively own the stock under 318, there should be no prohibition on accruing salaries paid to them and deducting that accrued salary. Well, the court said, problem is 318 doesn't apply here. Specifically, it only applies for provision of this subchapter. And the subchapter in question is subchapter B. But 267 is in subchapter C, I should say. But 267 is in subchapter B. So 318 does not have any impact on 267. And secondly, the rules are not expressly made applicable. And 318 says it only applies where expressly made applicable. 263C has its own rules for what who are related parties. And based on that, in essence, you have to use 263, or 267, I should say, and not use those things that are applicable for 318. Then they tried a couple of odd arguments. They claim, well, wait, we have over $5 million in revenue. And since we have over $5 million in revenue, IRC Section 448 requires a corporation to be on the accrual basis. And you know what? What you're telling us to do puts us on the cash basis of accounting. Well, that's violating the requirements of 448. Well, the opinion said there are a couple of big flaws in your argument. First, just need to remind you, though it's not really going to be relevant as we're going to discover, 448 only applies to C corporations, tax shelters, and partnership with a C corporation as a partner. Since the IRS was not alleging you were a tax shelter, guys, you're not required to be on the accrual basis based on 448. Now, you might be required to be there because it would misstate income otherwise. I'm not going to worry about that. Because they said, in any event, 267A does not deny them the right of the accrual basis of accounting. It just says certain accruals, the deduction will need to be deferred until the other side of the transaction recognizes the income. So only for a limited set of expenses does this put you on a cash basis. That's not a problem. Finally, the taxpayer tried to argue, well, you know, it's contrary to U.S. GAAP, and of course we don't want that to happen. And the court says, well, duh, it's contrary to U.S. GAAP. Lots of things in the tax law are contrary to U.S. GAAP. The fact it's contrary to U.S. GAAP has no impact on whether or not it should be deductible under this rule. So then the court goes on to say, well, here's the question. Is the ESOP a trust? Because if it's a trust, if there's a trust in there, then this rule is going to apply if the participants are beneficiaries of the trust. The court notes that, in fact, the ESOP plan document refers to the shares will be held in trust. In fact, under ERISA, that has to be true for this to be a qualified plan. The trust document itself reads like a traditional trust document. The participants are beneficiaries of the trust. And as such, the trust is holding those shares for the beneficiaries. So the court finds that, you know, it is a trust. Then the taxpayer said, couldn't be a trust the IRS meant. The court said, well, here's your problem. In 318, the Congress specifically said, we say trust, we don't mean qualified plan trust. But in 267, they never mentioned that. The court said, we got to assume they didn't mention it because they don't want that exclusion. They wanted the exclusion at 318. They don't want it here. Now, the court admitted that may not be totally correct in terms of Congress actually thinking about this. And to be frank, it's probable Congress didn't, because 267 was amended last before S corporations were able to have ESOP shareholders. So the shares could not have been in a employee retirement plan trust. But the court said they can't go change the law, the law as written. That can only be done by Congress. Congress hasn't done it. As such, they hold that, in fact, this meets the definition of a trust, and that since Congress has not specifically excluded qualified plans for definition of a trust for these purposes, no deduction will be allowed currently. Next, we're going to take a look at a case at an issue that gives the IRS's view of a case we talked about 2 months ago. 2 months ago, we talked about the Mescalero Apache Tribe versus Commissioner case, 148 TC number 11, that came down on April the 5th, 2017. Now we're going to take a look at Chief Counsel email 2017-23020 that came down on June the 9th. In that email, in the original case, the IRS was looking at the tribe, and they were arguing that some people the tribe had treated as independent contractors were actually employees of the tribe. Now, because of that, under Section 3402, the taxpayer could be required to pay in that withholding what it hadn't withheld from these employees. But under 3402D, if the taxpayer can show that, in fact, the employees, these people now being treated as employees, had reported that income on their tax return previously, then they don't have to pay in for that amount of income. Well, the tribe tried to find these people, but some of them they couldn't find because they had moved or it hadn't left forwarding information. And some of them they couldn't find because they're just simply are very, 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 very remote locations on this reservation. No phone service, no utilities, certainly no internet, no easy way to find people in those areas. So there were 70 people they couldn't find. When they went to tax court to challenge IRS's assessment, the tribe asked that the IRS in discovery give them, you know, tell them which of those 70 people had reported income from the tribe on their tax return. The IRS attempted to deny that claim, but the court said no. And they noted that, you know, we're going at this point, looking at the whole situation, there's these 70 people, the tribe did not locate them, but you know whether or not they paid the tax. So IRS, you need to tell the tribe if these people did. The court looked at the issue of, yes, we understand this is disclosing tax return information, but they said we got to balance that with the tribe's right to pay the proper amount of tax. And based on that, the court found that there was justification allowed under the code, specifically at 6103H4, to allow for that information to be produced at the trial. Now, some taxpayers are arguing during exam they want the IRS to tell them which of the people they're trying to reclassify have already reported the income. And now the IRS has been asked by memo, well, you know, the IRS chief counsel office was asked, do we have to tell them this? And the chief counsel said, no, you don't need to give them that information. The chief counsel takes the position that the case only dealt with a situation where there had been a reasonable attempt by the tribe to get the information. There had actually been, you know, we'd gone all the way through the system. The tribe had filed with the tax court challenging the IRS's position and now was in discovery. The IRS position on the memo is only in discovery might these be disclosed. And the court said, since 6103H doesn't require disclosure, you're even going to have to go all the way to file a motion with the court to force disclosure, because the service is not going to disclose it unless the court rules that, in fact, in this case, the interests of justice are best balanced by having the IRS disclose that information to the taxpayer. So Mescalero is an interesting case and useful, but it probably at this point, if the service is going to take this position, won't be terribly useful to those of us who are not in front of the tax court. But when you're in, and you know, almost all these cases are going to start outside the tax court. So during the exam time frame, yeah, we're just going to kind of be stuck. Next up, the IRS tries once again, and this time succeeds, in publishing regulations, proposed regulations, on the Bipartisan Budget Act's new partnership audit regime. The Bipartisan Budget Act of 2015 changed radically the way partnership exams will be conducted. The IRS had attempted to publish regulations in January, proposed regulations, that told us how this would work. Now, everyone pretty much agrees that what Congress passed is woefully short of enough information to tell us how these rules are going to work. So we desperately need these things fleshed out. Congress clearly expected the IRS to flesh them out. However, back in January, when the IRS issued these, tried to first issue these proposed regs, they had them done. Actually, you know, all the tax services, I got my hands on them because they were put through the system that normally they put it in when they announced, you know, we're going to be published in a couple of days in the Federal Register, we're going to have these regulations. Well, they went through that process, but then shortly thereafter, the new president issued an executive order that basically limited the issuance of new regulations. The IRS determined that these proposed regs arguably was in violation of that ruling and it couldn't be published. So they pulled back these regulations and they were never actually published in the Federal Register. Well, on June 14th, we did get proposed regulations published in the Federal Register. This is Reg-136118-15 on June the 14th. And because we now have them out, so now after the order, we're now back to where we have these regulations in play. Now, for those of you who may not remember, we did a full podcast on these regulations January 27th. You can find that on our website. It's January 7th, 27th, video and audio podcast to explain it. There we also had a fairly decent, about 50, 60 page write-up of the proposed regulations and how they would work. And that's also available for download. You can still do that. Now, the changes to these regs were very minor when they were re-released. The IRS fixed some typos, okay? They also, talked about some additional ideas about what they had about how they're going to have to handle tiered partnerships. And they removed a single example, example 3 in the imputed underpayment portion of the regulations. Otherwise, these are the same regs we had back in January. So if you wish to, you can go get that printout, again, from our website. It's linked to on the same page. It's actually linked to in this week's PDF, as well as that original broadcast. You can find all of that and our basic write-up. You can find all of that at kernfeldtaxdevelopments.com and, you know, grab the PDF this week and it'll all be there. Basically, you can go ahead and go along with those rules. Obviously, we're still going to have to wait for final regs to know for sure what's going to happen. The IRS hopes to have final regulations out by January 1st of 2018. Finally, this week, we have the IRS ruling that there is no relief for certain interests and penalties for people that are out of compliance before there is a natural disaster. This is Chief Counsel Email 2017-23023 issued on June the 9th. It looks at the natural disaster delay rules under Section 7508 Cap A of the Code. Under those rules, the IRS has the right to delay for up to a year the requirement that people take certain actions. For instance, quite often, you know, if there's a natural disaster, they'll say, well, any payroll tax deposits that would have been due, you know, immediately following the disaster, they'll be delayed for some time period. You can make them by that date. If there's a tax return that would be due during that time period, they also will provide a date by which, if you file it, it'll be deemed to be timely filed. The question becomes, because, you know, the rule allows for that, does this also suspend the running of interest and penalties if somebody had already failed to deposit the taxes before the disaster struck or had already failed to file a return timely? Obviously, the disaster strikes and the theory is, well, they couldn't get to the bank to pay the taxes, or they couldn't get to the post office now to file the tax return, or their CPA, you know, the CPA firm was underwater they used, so they couldn't electronically file. So do they get a stop of the running of interest and penalties? And this rules, the answer is no. The IRS ruled that, in fact, this only allows them to delay actions. And then there's no interest and penalties on those actions not being done. But if you're already out of compliance, tough luck. None of these rules are going to allow you, if you're out of compliance, to be able to file this document, you know, be able to stop the running of interest and penalties during that time frame. Interestingly enough, they direct you to Example 6 of Treasury Regulation 301-7508A-1F, and that example does pretty much walk you through why you don't get relief from anything you should have done before the disaster, that penalty and interest will continue to run. There is an interesting aside. This clearly, when you read the end of the memo, was in response to a query from a congressman. And of course, the IRS doesn't like to disappoint congressmen. So the IRS employee that asked this was told that he or she should suggest instead that this congressman can tell his constituents or the representatives that they should advocate for abatement based on reasonable cause due to the particular facts and circumstances in each case. So while they can't qualify for the automatic rule of 7508A, they might be able to get reasonable cause relief from getting out of those penalties. So, you know, they gave them an option because you don't want to disappoint the congressman, right? That's the way it works. Well, as I said earlier in this broadcast, we are getting to 120 this week in Phoenix, supposedly. And one of the nice things about taking CP in the summer is if you do that, you don't have to pay the air conditioning bill. You take live CPE, your state society will pay for keeping you cool during the day. And in Phoenix at 120, it's expensive to keep cool. So not a bad deal. So why don't you think about this summer, taking some continuing education courses and, you know, let the state society take care of your air conditioning bill. You know, we're here in Phoenix, and those of you on the video, you know, we got a nice picture here of the Phoenix area, Camelback Mountain in the front there. And basically, yeah, you know, it looks nice and bright. The problem is it's nice, bright, and 120. So yeah, go ahead, let the state society pay for your air conditioning bill. By the way, when we get to winter, don't forget, heating bills cost too. So, hey, in winter CPE, you can go ahead and let somebody else pay for heating and take care of that. Of course, probably best not to turn the heating or cooling all the way off. A, in Phoenix from 120, it'll take quite a while to cool your house down if you turned off the AC all day when it was 120 outside. B, even more interesting in the winter, depending on how cold it is, turning off the heat might cause some problems with certain things freezing. So, okay, not totally pay for heating and cooling for the day, but come close enough. This has been the Current Federal Tax Developments for the week of June the 19th, 2017. You can catch my updates on the website currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. You can also download a PDF from that site with articles on all today's topics. If you have any questions or comments, you can send them to me, edzollers@currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. You can also follow me on Twitter, my address there, @edzollers. Well, next week, I'll probably be posting a little bit later because I can't get back out of New Jersey until the following morning. So I'll be coming back to Phoenix Saturday afternoon. So I'll be posting a little bit later for those of you who look for the posts on early Saturday. That isn't happening this week because I seriously doubt that recording this in the Newark Airport, Liberty Airport, is not probably going to be conducive sound-wise to recording it. And B, I really doubt that the Wi-Fi connections are going to be good enough to make this work anyway. So watch for a little bit later, but we're going to watch for you next week. And be sure to keep up, and we'll keep track of what's going on in the area of federal taxes in the coming week.